Welcome to Hunting Williams. My name is Jim Rubin. I'm a senior attorney in the environment section. I want to thank, first of all, Hunting Williams for helping put this on. But I'd also like to welcome and thank everybody who's here on the telephone, particularly our speakers and our moderator. I hope people are on the telephone. We had a little telephone issue before, but I've been hearing lots of beeps. I particularly want to thank for this program ELI and particularly Leslie Brothers, Scott Chang, and Marsha McCarran for their work in putting this together. They helped organize, coordinate, and make the whole program work. I also want to thank the ABA for co-sponsoring this program. We have quite a few co-sponsors from the ABA in this program, from the SEER committee, including the Committee on Sustainable Development and Climate Change, which John is the chair of, the International Environmental Law Committee, which I'm a member of, as well as the Air Quality Committee, the Renewable Energy Committee, Electricity and Gas Marketing Committee, the Environmental Enforcement and Crimes Committee, and the International Energy and Resources Transaction Committee.
I guess we've gotten people's attention.
We got everybody's attention. And also International Law Section, International Environmental Law Committee. So this really does demonstrate, as David says, the great interest of the subject matter and the range of areas where this case may have impact and implications. Massive EPA is about 6 weeks old today, and we're all still trying to figure out what it means for our practices, for the specific litigation involved, as well as other cases and overall climate change law and policy. I'm not going to go further this information because that's for our panelists to discuss today, but I think we'll all learn something today. Just a few brief comments on proceedings and housekeeping. In terms of the panel discussion, we're not going to have presentations. John Dernbach will ask a series of questions, and the panelists will respond, and if they want to rebut or respond to other people's answers and questions, they are free to do so. At about 1:30, we're going to open up the discussions to questions from the studio audience here as well as on the telephone. We're being recorded by ELI. I wonder if recording people here, so it's all being taken down. Be mindful of that and try not to mutter things under your breath close to the microphones. It'll be picked up. ELI also has some material on this panel on their website. David, for instance, his testimony to Congress is on the website. The microphones for the telephone calls are located every other placemat. These little black things here are microphones. I tell you that because please do not spill things on them, hit them, rustle papers on them or anything. You'll blow everybody's eardrums out on the telephone. They're very, very sensitive. And for those who are the size who have questions later on, just stand up by a microphone. Bathroom breaks. There is a bathroom around the corner. You have to use a code 1500, and I'm telling you all that. I know if the toilet paper's missing later on today, we're going to have some problems with you guys, but that's the code. I'm going to mute the lines for those on the telephone until we're open for questions. If you have any problems getting back on the line, or for some reason you get cut off, email jrubin, R-U-B-I-N, at hunton.com immediately, and I'll try to make sure you're back on. At this point, I want to turn things over to John Dernbach and give John a brief introduction. John is a professor of law at Widener University in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Recently returned to teaching after some time at the head of the policy office at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. And he was actually in that department in its prior manifestation for a number of years. Professor Dernbach teaches environmental law, property, administrative law, international law, and a seminar on global warming. So he covers all the areas we'll be talking about today. He also was a co-author of an amicus brief in the Mass EPA case on behalf of 18 climate scientists. He has said before he chairs the ABA Committee on Sustainable Development, Ecosystems, and Climate Change. And he's a graduate of Michigan Law School and University of Wisconsin. Let me turn things over to John, and thanks everyone for coming.
Well, thank you, Jim. Can everybody hear me?
No.
Better? Can you hear me now?
Better.
Better, okay. Can you hear me now?
That's actually for the recording. You have to talk into this.
Okay.
Just lean forward.
I guess we'll all speak up. I also want to thank Scott Chang and Leslie Carruthers and others from the Environmental Law Institute, including Aaron Weybreck and Sarah Birmingham, who are here with us and are sort of trying to make this presentation work from a recording point of view. Jim Rubin has and Bill Fang have played a very large role in organizing this event. Bill is one of the vice chairs of the Sustainable Development, Ecosystems, and Climate Change Committee. And Jim and Bill have been very, very helpful in organizing this and played, I think, probably a larger role than anyone with the possible exception of Scott Chang in making this happen. we're going to have a panel discussion today in which I moderate and ask questions, and the four folks who will respond to questions are the following. To my immediate right is Paul Turner. He is a partner in the energy group at Sutherland, Asbill, and Brennan. His practice focuses on energy markets, and particularly the physical and financial trading of energy commodities. When we were talking beforehand, he said, I'm an energy lawyer, not an environmental lawyer. He has represented some clients in some of the nation's largest energy company bankruptcies, and he's a vice chair of the ABA Committee on Gas and Electricity Marketing. To my far right is Norm Fickthorn. He's a partner here at Hunton & Williams. He focuses on resources, regulatory, and environmental law. And he particularly does a lot of work on the Clean Air Act. Norm represented the Electric Utility Group respondent as the lead counsel in Massachusetts versus EPA. He has also representing an electric utility in federal district court in the public nuisance case that the Southern District of New York decided in 2005, Connecticut versus American Electric Power Company, and which is now on appeal in the Second Circuit. To my immediate left is Bob Myers. He's the Deputy Assistant Administrator for Air and Radiation at US EPA. The Office of Air and Radiation is, of course, responsible for implementation of the Clean Air Act, as well as federal radiation standards. Before that, he was the Chief Deputy Counsel for Energy and Environment at the House Energy and Commerce Committee, where he oversaw committee efforts on the Clean Air Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, and several titles of the Energy Policy Act of 2005. And to my far left is David Doniger, who is the Policy Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Natural Resource Defense Council's Climate Center. He came back to NRDC in 2001 after serving for 8 years in the Clinton administration. He directed the climate change policy work at the US EPA, and before that he was counsel to the head of EPA's Clean Air Program. He has served for a brief time at the Council on Environmental Quality and first started working at NRDC in 1978. And as I said before, the object here, this is a PowerPoint-free event. The idea is to have folks talking to each other and responding to questions. And our object is to try and map the landscape after the decision in Massachusetts versus EPA. After, as Jim mentioned, today is 6 weeks to the day, and almost to the hour, actually, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided this case. And I think, as most of us know, the court decided three things. The court decided that Massachusetts had standing to prosecute its claims. It melded, in a sense, the doctrinal standing law under the Lujan case from some years ago with a much older decision, Georgia versus Tennessee Copper Company, in deciding that. The second thing the court decided was that greenhouse gases are pollutants under the Clean Air Act. EPA had previously said that they weren't. Now they are. And the third thing is that EPA, the court decided, had improperly denied EPA's, or excuse me, not EPA's, the petition that was filed to regulate greenhouse gases for motor vehicles under Section 202 of the Clean Air Act. What the court basically said is that the factors that EPA employed in denying that petition were factors that were outside the scope of the statute, and that EPA should make a decision based on the statute itself. And as I indicated, I think this changes the landscape a lot. There's been, and what we're going to try and figure out today is in what ways the landscape has been changed, to try and get a better sense of that. The one thing that I did in preparing for this event is I sent an email to Jim Mielke, who, as many of you know, argued this case on behalf of the state of Massachusetts. And Jim, who couldn't be here today, I asked him, well, is there anything you want us all to hear? And he sent me this back, and I'll start with this, and then I'll go to the first question. Jim says, we are hopeful that the case will help spur additional action by Congress Although we no longer need to wait for new legislation in order to achieve meaningful reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, we have no intention of resting on our laurels, but will instead redouble our efforts, working with other states and environmental groups to press forward on all fronts. And I think, as some of you know, Massachusetts has not rested on its laurels. There was an energy efficiency lawsuit that they brought last week, and they announced, I think, just not too long ago that they're going to start considering greenhouse gas emissions in environmental reviews under state law. So whatever else this case has done, it's been a real shot in the arm for the state of Massachusetts in the work that they've done. But the immediate question, though, is what exactly we had a petition for rulemaking. The petition for rulemaking was denied. The court said that the petition for rulemaking was wrongfully denied and sent it back to EPA. And so the first question goes to Bob Myers, our colleague at EPA. So now it's back in your lap. What?
Not to stand on procedure, but technically isn't back in our lap yet. The D.C. Circuit last week, towards the end of the week, issued a two-sentence order. And under that order, the parties are to submit motions for further proceedings by June 7th. So I think that obviously I've read the Supreme Court cases, everybody else, and I think that we fully expect that, you know, these issues will be before the agency, you know, in the relative near term, but technically the remand is not back in front of the agency right now. As to where we go from there, I mean, I think I would cite the possibility of further court involvement by the pursuant to the motions being that will be filed. Second, I guess I would observe with regard to 202, although addressing the Supreme Court opinion, 202 itself doesn't have any legislative procedural requirements when one gets a petition. The petition, the original 1999 petition, was presented to the agency on several bases, including just the constitutional right to petition government. So the procedure within 202 is not set out in statute. Once it gets back, once we decide how to address it, then we'll be looking to our normal statutory and administrative processes. So, well, I'm done with my question. I better cut it short before I say too much.
Well, one question we had talked about, though, is you said that there was no statutory procedure, but is there a procedure that you all intend to employ? And what are you comfortable telling us about that?
Actually, what I'm comfortable telling you is what Tony Snow said this morning regarding an announcement to occur at 1:25 today from the president. And Mr. Snow said the president will make an announcement about his directing the administration to take action to implement his 2010 plan to reduce the nation's addiction to oil. He will announce his latest efforts to ensure that the nation is taking aggressive steps to reduce gasoline consumption. Otherwise, there's some other quotes, but I guess I would say this is a matter that has received substantial attention at the agency, as you might expect for a Supreme Court case of this magnitude. And we've been reviewing both the case, obviously, and looking at our options under the Clean Air Act. And I believe this afternoon we'll have some clarification on a step forward, probably about an hour or so from now, which unfortunately puts me in a little bit of a constraint here. But, you know, we all want to take a coffee break.
Yeah, we're scheduled to go till 2:00.
We can speculate about it.
Yeah. David, do you want to?
I was very honored and pleased to be part of such a good team with the states and the environmental groups who worked together to get the outcome in Massachusetts. And we continue to work together. So you'll see further coordinated action from the states and some other states which have been involved in other cases, the coalition of environmental organizations. We're engaged, for example, in working with the states of California and Vermont to defend with those states against the lawsuits brought by auto companies against the California and Vermont greenhouse gas emission standards under Section 209 of the Clean Air Act. California has authority there. You know, Bob may need to be circumspect about what's happening at 1:30, and I can speculate with, you know, based on information we picked up this morning from reporters. It may be that what the president's going to announce this afternoon is that the Clean Air Act, that the administration will open a Clean Air Act proceeding to make to carry out the policy which was announced in the State of the Union address to improve fuel economy and to reduce the greenhouse gases in motor fuel. And in some respects, it's quite a stunning move after 6 years or so of denying that the Clean Air Act provides authority to have been told 6 weeks ago that it does provide authority, and then to pivot and propose, if this is what is actually coming, to reduce CO2 emissions from motor vehicle tailpipes in lieu of or maybe in combination with the CAFE proposals that the administration announced it was intending to do in the State of the Union. Now, the State of the Union proposal actually was kind of limited because the president said, or his administration said, this is what I would like to do under the CAFE law, but I need an amendment of the CAFE law to give me more flexibility in the form of standards for passenger vehicles in order to do that. And Congress has been working on legislation which would give him the flexibility in the form of the standard, but would also mandate a level of improvement of 4% per year or so, which is the same number that the president's, that the administration's analysis that accompanied the president's speech said was the target. So it will be very interesting to find out if the administration will commit now to use its Clean Air Act powers to achieve the improvement which it said it was in favor of doing under CAFE. And if we can get the level of improvement that was promised, and the level of improvement that's implicit or that's explicit in the legislation that's pending, then this could be an interesting outcome. Same on the alternative fuels. The alternative fuels proposal made in January or in the State of the Union has a bit of a Trojan horse in it, because it's not just renewable fuels, it's alternative fuels. And alternative fuels includes liquid coal, which has a very bad greenhouse gas profile. So if you're trying to achieve results under the Clean Air Act, presumably they would have to be keyed to greenhouse gas improvements, and the liquid coal element will be very interesting to see how they actually handle under that.
Anybody? Bob? Okay. Too early.
I thought if I spoke long enough, you'd be free to speak.
I appreciate that. I think I was looking for some further email. I think
Houston, we have a problem.
I hate to be in this. I'm a Schedule C political appointee at the agency, so I'm sensitive to.
I understand the situation.
Thanks. But I think that Tony Snow was also quoted as saying that he will ask the administration to start implementing the 2010 program through regulatory action. At the same time, he will continue to urge Congress to pass legislation to advance the goal. addressing legislation, which I'm very familiar with, I think, you know, David is right in our own analysis in terms of cold liquids without sequestration shows about 118% increase in GHG profile on life cycle basis versus when compared straight to diesel. When you use sequestration, carbon capture and sequestration, again, you're going to have to assume some certain efficiencies by that, and we calculated a 3.7% increase. There are other types of analysis, nettled in analysis with a decrease, and there are other parameters that we can go in. So I would also make the observation that our additional analysis in terms of equipment side on diesel versus gasoline, if you're talking about a replacement equipment, you can get about a 40% GHG profile increase if you use a diesel vehicle versus gasoline vehicle. All other things being equal. I'm not trying to project an analytical but for here, and we haven't done the analysis to do that. But I would note, U.S. fleet, light duty fleet, is about 97% or so gasoline operated right now. And one of the strategies broadly for addressing climate change is something like the European model, assuming that you can get these vehicles into our Tier 2 compliance with the strict emission limits that are in Tier 2 right now. For every diesel vehicle, you have the prospect of increasing your GHG profile from the transportation sector. So that's just what I would comment right now on that, and then we can move on to other issues.
It's interesting because we were talking about getting ready for this event. We said, there's legal implications to Massachusetts versus EPA, and there are political implications. And so I don't think any of us who are prepared for this event were thinking that there would be a White House announcement in the middle of it.
It's obviously triggered by this event.
Yeah, obviously. Okay, so we have Jim Rubin and Bill Fang to thank for that. But a question, though. I mean, maybe just sort of a way of introducing the political question. Do you think that we would have had this announcement today, but for the decision in Mass versus EPA?
Well, I mean, let me put my 2 cents in on that. I think what's happening is the administration has been somewhat backed into a corner by Congress pursuing CAFE legislation that the administration has not yet endorsed, in that it's more specific. It's not inconsistent with the goals that the administration announced, but it's more specific and locks them in, and the administration has been unwilling to endorse that legislation. But that legislation is progressing, so there's some sense of being backed. And then there's being backed into a corner by the Supreme Court decision, in that up till now, the administration's position was that CO2 is not a pollutant, not a subject to be dealt with under the Clean Air Act. So I think we would not be having this announcement but for Massachusetts and but for the pressure coming from the Hill on CAFE and more generally on greenhouse gas legislation.
I think that one issue that I thought we were going to talk about, but it may be superseded by this political development, I don't know, is what EPA is going to do with the endangerment finding under Section 202A1, which I think has been the focus of the analysis and speculation as to what EPA will do in response, in direct response to the Supreme Court's decision. And I don't know if Bob is prepared to say anything as to that particular issue. I do think it's useful to recall what the Supreme Court did on that, which is to say not that the endangerment criterion, which is a prerequisite for regulation under 202A1, had been met, but that EPA had an obligation to explain better or provide a new, more reasonable justification for its decision not to regulate, or, of course, to make a different regulatory decision and to actually regulate. But in addressing those issues, EPA would clearly have to engage, it seems to me, the question whether the endangerment criterion under Section 202A1 had been met, or, alternatively, whether EPA did not have sufficient information, the Supreme Court's phrase, sufficient information to determine whether or not that endangerment criterion had been met.
certainly I won't parse your rendition of what the Supreme Court said. I think it's fairly accurate and straightforward, or is accurate and straightforward. I don't need any qualifiers. And I think that that certainly will be an issue in any when this comes back before the agency. We have to do something, and I think that's clear from the Supreme Court case, is that the Supreme Court said all the arguments we raised previously with regard to policy, other policies, with regard to were not sufficient. We had to look to the Act and to the criteria that are in the Act, and that's fully what we intend to do when the D.C. Circuit finishes its work and we have this back in front of us. So, because these things sometimes get confused, I also would say that we also have a separate process on the California waiver. It was mentioned earlier, and Dave referenced accurately, that's a 209 decision versus 202 decision. 209 does have not pages of statutory process, but has a process which we've implemented roughly or so 80 or so times since the modern form of that waiver authority was put into the Act in 77. Under that criteria, we have proceeded to announce two public hearings, and we're proceeding in that. We have one here in D.C., I think, a couple of weeks.
22nd,
and another in Sacramento the week following, and we have a public comment period of June 15th there. So I think we are moving forward on several fronts. Again, I wish it would be more explicit, but the President is head of our executive branch, Commander in Chief, and
get him on the line.
Well, this is sort of anticipated. It goes right into the next question, then, and maybe the proper thing to ask is, from either a political point of view or a legal point of view, does Mass versus EPA make it more likely or less likely that the waiver will be granted?
I mean, the waiver decision is under 209, and we have to look at the statute under 209. And I mean, certainly I'm not going to argue that the Supreme Court case isn't relevant in some fashion to that, but the way 209 works is the burden's on the agency, essentially, to say that the waiver is not needed for either that California was A, somewhat arbitrary and capricious in their consideration of the standard, B, that's not consistent there's not consistency with federal standards, there's not consistency, and I can delve deeper in the onion there, I won't there, or that there's not a compelling and extraordinary reason why it needs a waiver. So 209 sets up a different statutory decision for the agency, just in the way the question is presented to the agency, and the burden of proof, frankly, is on the agency and those that would seek to not approve the California decision. Of course, the history of this is that California regulated fuels and vehicles long before, well, not that long, but in the mid-60s, early mid-60s, before the modern Clean Air Act in 70, and because of that history and because of the recognized unique California air quality problems, they were given that separate authority that's separate from the general preemption elsewhere in the Act over motor vehicles and fuels. So I think 209 does present different issues. If the question goes to how we look at GHG now versus pre-Supreme Court, obviously there's an impact in terms of how we look at it now that the Supreme Court has told us it's pollutant under the Act.
David, anything you want to add to that? By the way, I'm told that we're the little black guys that are sitting in the front of each of us, we need to speak more directly into those.
The phone calls are not, people are saying it's not clear enough, so you talk.
Sorry, Bob. Well, I hope that EPA will move forward to grant the waiver. As Bob says, the burden is on opponents of the waiver. The danger, the question of danger, is not traditionally the relevant under the waiver, in that the way things are structured, California gets to decide whether it thinks a pollutant needs to be regulated, and then EPA's evaluation is about several narrow matters, One is an evaluation of whether California's got a, whether opponents have shown that California has an unreasonable position about the technology or the lead time. And there is a requirement that California demonstrate that it has compelling, sorry, there is an opportunity for others to demonstrate that California does not have compelling and extraordinary conditions which warrant having these standards. That traditionally has been an evaluation not of the individual standard, but of the whole California program. And since California still has the smog problem it started with, and the need for the program to combat that program, that problem, the compelling and extraordinary conditions test has never been an obstacle to the granting of a waiver. So we hope that things will proceed quickly to grant the waiver. The California standards have been picked up in 11 other states so far, and two more are in the administrative process. Together, the 11 make up more than, including California, 12, I guess, make up more than a third of the car market in the United States. And this is a pretty important state initiative, which it would be good to get the green flag for and allow to proceed.
What are the consequences? Thank you. What are the consequences of the decision that greenhouse gases are pollutants under the Clean Air Act, as Bob indicated, is not just that they're pollutants for purposes of Section 202, which is the section under which the Supreme Court decided this case. If they're pollutants for one purpose, then it looks like they're pollutants for a whole bunch of other purposes. And one of the other legal claims that has been out there is that there is an obligation or a duty, perhaps, or at least good reason for EPA to regulate greenhouse gases from stationary sources. I think, as you all know, that's a name for power plants and buildings and facilities that don't move, as opposed to motor vehicles, which is what we've been discussing. And Norm, you represent a lot of the folks who would be affected by that. There's a legal claim in a case called New York versus EPA that EPA should have established limits, I believe, under Section 111, new source performance standards, for coal-fired power plants and other sources. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that case and then the implications that Massachusetts versus EPA might have on that case.
Sure. The case really started back a few years ago when a citizen suit was filed in California, in federal district court in California, to try to force EPA to consider revisions to the existing new source performance standards for electric utility steam generating units, basically conventionally powered power plants, as well as certain other types of boilers. EPA does have an obligation under Section 111 of the Clean Air Act to review and, if appropriate, revise the new source performance standards every 8 years. EPA had not done so within 8 years. I'm speaking broadly. I think there were some dispute about EPA's actions on certain aspects of it. But the long and the short of it is the district court ordered EPA to conduct a rulemaking to consider revisions to the standards, not necessarily to make revisions, but to consider them. And EPA has an obligation in these kinds of proceedings to consider more up-to-date technology that may have developed since the standards were originally promulgated or last revised. EPA, in accordance with the court's order, published proposed revisions to certain aspects of the new source performance standards in February of 2005 and took final action in February of 2006. EPA did not propose any new source performance standards for carbon dioxide, but in comments, certain states and environmental groups asked EPA to develop and promulgate CO2 standards. And EPA's response to those comments was two sentences. Now, this was, by the way, this response that EPA gave in early 2006 was after EPA in 2003 had made the determination that was the subject of the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA, namely that EPA does not have authority to regulate greenhouse gases for the purpose of addressing global climate change under the Clean Air Act, and EPA, in making that determination, did not limit its decision to on authority to simply motor vehicle regulation under 202, which was the narrow subject of the Supreme Court's decision, but rather said also that EPA lacked authority to regulate greenhouse gases under other provisions of the Clean Air Act, including specifically Section 111. So when EPA responded to these comments that it received in this rulemaking, EPA said EPA's statutory authority for establishing the New Source Performance Standards, NSPS, to control air pollutants from stationary sources is under Section 111, and that EPA has concluded that it does not presently have the authority to set NSPS to regulate CO2 or other greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change. That was it. That was the full response. EPA did not, for example, discuss the specific language of Section 111 as it might bear on this question. It did not address any policy considerations that might influence its decision on whether to regulate. It did not discuss issues of scientific uncertainty. Those were all things that EPA did in addressing the 202 motor vehicle regulation, but did not do so here with stationary sources. I think that what we're looking at is clearly at some point, and if Bob disagrees with this, he should say so, but I'm assuming that we will see a remand of the 111 issue with respect to greenhouse gases at some point for EPA to give full consideration to all the issues that go to authority to regulate, and also how EPA would exercise, whether EPA would exercise that authority, and if so, how it would exercise that authority. There's been some talk about the fact that the so-called endangerment language in Section 111, which is a prerequisite to regulation under that section, is identical to or similar to the endangerment language in Section 202, the provision at issue in the Supreme Court case. In fact, it is somewhat different, and in 111 it refers to a category of stationary sources must cause or contribute significantly to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare, whereas 202 focuses on an air pollutant causing or contributing to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. The source category issue here was listed as a source category under 111 by EPA decades ago. So if you look at the narrow question of what it is that EPA has an obligation to consider with respect to endangerment, it is somewhat different from the 202 context. How EPA will address that difference and other questions that go beyond that to questions such as if EPA were to develop a regulation, what weight would it give to a variety of factors that I think are extremely complicated in this context, such as the cost of regulation? What kind of technology would you be looking at? What is feasible? These are all factors that EPA is required to consider when it develops a new source performance standard or revises a new source performance standard. So I see when this matter gets back to EPA, I see a whole range of issues that the agency will presumably consider and presumably consider in the context of notice and comment rulemaking proceedings of some sort. At this point, of course, it's really too early for us to say what the schedule for that would be, and I would say that there are motions pending in the D.C. Circuit, sort of competing motions as to what the D.C. Circuit should do with this matter, because it is still at the D.C. Circuit level. It's not back before EPA. The state and environmental group petitioners have asked the court for summary reversal and vacature of the agency's decision that it does not have authority and a remand to EPA for further action consistent with the Supreme Court's opinion. EPA has asked for more time to provide a more substantive response. They've asked for an extension of deadline for response to the petitioner's motion until June 18th. At the same time, they'd say that motions to govern further proceedings should be filed June 18th. So we're sort of in procedural limbo right at the moment, and I think the D.C. Circuit will be sorting this out over the coming weeks.
Bob, you want to add anything?
No, I think that was a good summary of where things are, as well as noting statutory differences here. I quoted Tony Snow earlier. I think I'll probably quote the administrator testimony in front of the Senate Environment and Public Works. This is a very complex assessment that needs to be done, and that's something that we've been proceeding with. And I think his response is essentially that, you know, we'll be addressing these issues in an expeditious but responsible manner.
David, let me reframe the question for you slightly.
Okay.
One of the issues that existed in the last congressional session for coal-fired power plants was whether we ought to have a three-pollutant bill or a four-pollutant bill, the fourth pollutant being carbon dioxide. Is it possible, after Massachusetts versus EPA, to talk about three-pollutant legislation anymore in any meaningful sense?
No, I don't think so. The since the Massachusetts decision, there have been three four-pollutant power plant bills introduced in the Congress from Alexander, from Carper, and from Sanders. And all of these bills can be married up with multi-sector and legislation. So, in so far as you'd have perhaps multi-sector carbon legislation, which covers, of course, the power sector, but also has sort of as an appendage that makes sense from our point of view, and perhaps also from the power industry's point of view, to deal with the three other pollutants from the power sector as well. So that's a possibility. And the Environment Public Works Committee, I would expect over the course of the next several months, will be looking at all of the legislative proposals which have been made. And there are, as I said, there are three 4P proposals, and there are, I think, four or five. There's actually one other 4P proposal from Feinstein that came in. Excuse me, that's just carbon that came in earlier. And there are three or four multi-sector, multi-greenhouse gas emission bills. The Lieberman-McCain bill, the Sanders-Boxer bill, and a couple others. And, of course, Mr. Bingaman has a proposal, which he's been developing, which is a multi-sector proposal as well. So I think all those things are in the hopper. And there'll be some constructive process I'm looking forward to fuse them into something that is an evolution of and improvement on all of the individual proposals.
Norm, let me ask you the same question. Is it now, as a practical matter, impossible to talk about three pollutant legislation?
Well, it's. I don't think it's impossible to talk about it. I do think, though, that with all the activity on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, and interest in legislation, new legislation to address global climate change issues, that it seems very likely to me that anything that gets serious consideration in either the House or the Senate would have, you know, some component of climate change regulation. There are a whole variety of proposals that are out there, of course, and I think one thing that we're in the middle of now in the legislative debate is sorting out the merits and demerits of the various proposals, trying to figure out what makes the most sense, and perhaps eventually coming to some consensus as to first whether to adopt some kind of regulatory regime through legislation, and then what the elements of that regime should be. And I tend to think that that's going to take some time, and it may take beyond the current Congress, although I tend to think this year and next year are sort of the at least the testing ground, if you will. And I think about, for example, what happened with the Clean Air Act Amendments of 1977. What we had was, in 1975 and 1976, extensive activity in the House and the Senate to develop comprehensive legislation that didn't quite make it through by the end of the Congress in 1976. But then in 1977, with the new president taking office, President Carter at that time, and all the work having been done to think through the issues, Congress did pass comprehensive legislation in 1977. We may see a similar pattern now, but to answer your direct question, I really think that as a practical matter, you're going to see, you know, either 1P, which is carbon, or perhaps 4P, which is carbon plus the others.
Paul, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. And one thing that I sort of find a bit interesting as well in this regard is the sort of power plants in the utility sectors don't fall into sort of a uniform category, because you have a lot of the merchant sector in the power sector, which is principally natural gas. I mean, that's where a lot of the generation has come from, in the merchant sector, who are well positioned with the addition of the carbon regulation, as opposed to some of the older utilities where, you know, there's going to be some real struggle and a significant amount of cost with the additional regulation. And so it's likely to affect those sectors quite differently.
Okay. Did I give you a chance to answer that?
No, you didn't, but that's fine. I've worked up on the Hill for a long time, so I'm probably not prone to making a whole lot of predictions about it. I think, you know, that Congress can kind of do what it wants to do, and you know, the Supreme Court was, you know, interpreting a law that Congress had passed, so Congress could pass an entirely different law if they really want to. Their flexibility is inherently, you know, almost infinite in this area, as how they would want to approach a problem. I think David and others were talking about the political realities on the Hill versus their institutional ability to reshape this. So, I think when the 3P bill under Chairman Inhofe was clear skies was marked up, it locked up on a 9-9 vote back about 2 years or so ago, and there it stood. So I don't think the political lineup has changed much to make you think that fundamentally is, I mean, it's obviously changed with the last election. I mean that was as far as the bill got before. So we'll just have to wait and see. These are, I think, what they're finding now is by the amount of hearings, the amount of forms that they're doing, that this is exceedingly complex to do. My own history doesn't go back to the 77 Act amendments, but I did work, you know, on a personal staff level prior to the 90 amendments, and saw what it took to put those together, and the hearings and the series of hearings that flowed through the 80s on acid rain, leading to the, you know, submission in 1989 of the President Bush's Clean Air Act amendments, and then another year and a half to get that over the line. So I think these are very, very lengthy, detailed, contentious endeavors for Congress. So I just would make the simple observation that anything they do will probably take, in my opinion, some time to get over the finish line.
Okay, a couple of other questions about the Clean Air Act, actually, because there appears to be numerous potential implications for the Clean Air Act. There have been, from time to time, questions about whether EPA ought to regulate carbon dioxide as a criteria pollutant under Section 108, and that, under the statute, would lead to a national ambient air quality standard for carbon dioxide, and it's easy to imagine if there would be one for carbon dioxide, there might be one for other greenhouse gas pollutants. And I guess in terms of both the politics and the law, I'd like to ask the folks on the panel to address that. In terms of how does Massachusetts versus EPA change the landscape on that question, and whether you think that is something that ought to be taken seriously. We can start anywhere.
I guess I'll offer my view. I think that clearly, let's assume for the sake of argument that at some point EPA makes what we've called an endangerment finding under Section 202. A question has arisen already as to, if EPA did that, what implication might that have for Section 108? Because Section 108 has similar language regarding endangerment. I think that just by way of background, it's useful to know that in the Supreme Court litigation, there was some briefing on this issue, and in the D.C. Circuit before that. The intervener states, there were 10 states that intervened in the case in support of EPA, and those states' primary argument was that if the courts deem CO2 and other greenhouse gases to be air pollutants under the Clean Air Act, and if you hypothesize that at some point that decision might result in these pollutants, these substances now having been determined to be pollutants, being actually regulated under the Ambient Air Quality Standard program, the states would face an impossible task because presumably any ambient air quality standard, and again it would be a national ambient air quality standard, would be set at a level that the states would really have no ability to meet, or to put another way, the states would not be able to meaningfully influence the level of global atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases, because these gases are distributed generally uniformly throughout the global atmosphere. The Ambient Air Quality Standard program, like I think most of the Clean Air Act, is designed to deal with relatively localized air pollution problems, not global problems. That's why, for example, we have a Title VI to the Clean Air Act that deals with stratospheric ozone depletion. I think that there is a general recognition, at least implicit, on the part of even the petitioners in the case, that there could be some workability problems with an ambient air quality standard for greenhouse gases, simply because the states wouldn't be able to develop any kind of meaningful implementation plans to try to achieve or obtain an ambient air quality standard for these pollutants. And in their brief in the Supreme Court, their opening brief, the petitioners seem to put some distance between the kind of Title II motor vehicle regulation they were seeking and the possibility of regulation under the Ambient Air Quality Standard program, noting, for example, that there were different regulatory triggers, that was their phrase, for 108 Ambient Air Quality Standard or criteria pollutant listing, which is the first step in setting an Ambient Air Quality Standard program. So I think that there are a number of issues that would really have to be worked through to even begin to envision an ambient air quality standard for CO2 or other greenhouse gases. And I frankly think that the machinery in the Act, the provisions in the machinery in the Act, are not set up to allow that kind of program to work the way Congress intended that program to work.
Paul, do you want to add anything before we turn it over to the other folks? Okay. David?
I think that's actually a good analysis, and actually read very closely what we filed in the Supreme Court. The Clean Air Act really can be thought of as a collection of many statutes that work independently. Titles that are separate from one another, and even within Title I, sections that are separate from one another. So the Clean Air Act has always had these two sort of belt and suspenders approach to the conventional pollution problem, which is you want to set an ambient goal and ratchet back pollution as necessary to achieve it. But also there are these technology-based provisions, Section 111, 202, others, which are not linked to achieving the ambient objective, but are basically premised on the idea that if there is a danger, there is a value in reducing the pollution to the extent feasible within a technological and economic set of constraints, and that's unhooked to whether that is more than enough or less than enough to achieve a given ambient objective. And then there are other titles of the Clean Air Act that are not either technology-based or ambient-based. For example, Title IV of the Clean Air Act, which sets a nationwide cap on a quantity of sulfur dioxide to be allowed in the air. So the Clean Air Act is a collection of things. Now, there was a legal strategy in the litigation of this case on the part of some of the opponents, including the states that Norm mentioned, to try to tie it all back to ambient air quality standards and say the whole point of the Clean Air Act, or the only point of the Clean Air Act, is to achieve ambient air quality standards. That's not true. and to argue that if you trigger one part of the Clean Air Act that's technology-based, it inevitably will trigger a part of the Clean Air Act that's based on the ambient air quality standards. And I think there is a provision in Section 108 which can be used to say that it's more than just endangerment that EPA has to find in order to set down the ambient air quality standards. There's also a line of cases in the D.C. Circuit that allow the agency to give impossibility excuses or reasons for not carrying out what would appear to be the clear meaning of a statute. But those have to be used narrowly. So if there were actually an unworkability of a statute standards, it would only apply so as to excuse you from operating under the ambient air quality standards provisions. It would not apply to the motor vehicles or the Section 111 power plant provisions where that workability problem doesn't exist. So short answer is nobody's planning, to my knowledge, to try to get an ambient air quality standard set for greenhouse gases. And I think this will remain theoretical for quite a while.
Okay. Well, then I won't ask you the theoretical question, Bob. Let me ask you different about what you would do if you got one of those petitions. Let me ask a different question, though.
Well, we did. We were sued on that.
Yeah, you had one. You had one. And then
right, but that suit was withdrawn, and although I don't know what everyone in the world is intending to do, my understanding is that no one is planning to reinstitute that suit.
Well, let me ask a somewhat different question then, and sort of to exhaust the possibilities with the Clean Air Act, because we've talked about 202, 209, 111, and 108 through 110. Okay, so now the question is, all right, are there other parts of the Clean Air Act where potential regulation is a real issue? And Bob, this one is, I'll start with you, is potential regulation is a real issue after Massachusetts versus EPA?
Well, certainly there are other parts of the Clean Air Act that could be, or at least it could be argued that are implicated by the decision. And we referenced, in passing Title VI, the stratospheric ozone, and there are provisions within that that have sort of a generalized authority to prevent harm. 615 in specific is a provision. In terms of what we're contemplating in terms of regulations, I think it's 115.
We're getting there.
I'll demur based on today's events for the president's announcement. We're dealing with I guess I make a general observation. The Clean Air Act is heavily litigated, we could be litigating on any number of issues, so it's impossible for me to say what our response is going to be in any one case. Going on what sort of David indicated in terms of the history of the Act, I think it is true in terms of air quality control districts. I mean, they go back to the 67 Air Pollution Act before we even had any sort of procedure to make people do something to comply with the ambient standards. So you're dealing with a concept which is at least 40 years old and actually older than that, and you're dealing with a structure that I think many of have observed. If people haven't looked at it, I'd look at our former general counsel's testimony from EPW a couple weeks ago, who pointed out in terms of NACs, where if you if the science and predictions in terms of GHG or at least CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is correct, you've got a situation for foreseeable future with CO2 emission levels going up. Inherently, that's a different situation with an act where you're setting the standard, people are trying to get down to it. So there are some, I think, some objective, non-legal, non-prejudicial observations people could say with respect to NACs in terms of how the agency would approach it. Again, We are really constrained by the situation we're in, where we are looking at all these issues, but are proceeding very carefully.
All right. Let's sort of move the focus here a little bit. One of the things that happens with this, as we've talked about this, is the consequences of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases being pollutants under the Clean Air Act cuts across the entire statute. And one of the things that sort of the side effects of this, or maybe more direct effects, is there exists now an emissions trading market for carbon. And I, Paul, one of the questions, I guess, one way to measure the impact of this case is to say, well, all right, so has that market changed at all? Because what it's sounding like is there's an enhanced likelihood of regulation of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas pollutants across sort of a range of sectors, whatever the however that likelihood eventually plays out. And how's the market responding to that?
Sure, and let me actually sort of correct the. I think you may have misspoke or I misheard. Currently, there is not a significant market in the U.S. for the trading of CO2. There is a sort of voluntary futures exchange.
Yeah, the carbon climate.
The Chicago
climate.
That's
exchange.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There are active trading programs in some of the other types of emissions, but. To get to your question, to the extent that you have a significantly greater regulation of carbon, you know, it's likely to have, frankly, sort of some significant effects on future prices for power, as the supply mix of generation gets shifted around as those that require the sort of purchase of emissions credits sort of become relatively more expensive, so that natural gas plants would tend to run more. That likewise likely could have the effect of sort of continuing the volatility in the natural gas markets, and you'll likely see a lot of the trading companies sort of get much more involved in the markets in carbon, so that they'll be providing hedging services. They'll sort of, try and bring liquidity to that market, so that they can to provide that service. And one thing, as you know, you had asked before before we started the call, you sort of said, well, have we seen this sort of, if you will, this carbon premium sort of built into pricing yet? And I certainly, in the transactions for generating units and sort of companies with generation, as of yet, I haven't seen that come in, just because of how recent the case is. But you certainly would expect to see that come in. Also, as people are sort of contracting for long-term power, sort of engaging those transactions, you would expect them to sort of have to build that into their forward price curves in the prices they offer, if they're offering fixed price power. I've actually had several conversations with folks about whether it makes sense to add in sort of regulatory change clauses into those transactions, so that they sort of, because there's so much unpredictability in what regulation may look like, that it's hard to build that into price curves, and so it creates a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace for power.
Is that generally how you'd characterize the impact of this case on energy markets?
In the sense that it's likely to have significant impacts on power prices as well as gas prices, but. There's a significant amount of uncertainty, so it's very hard to plan for that sort of thing.
Can I comment on that? I mean, I think what we're in the transition from a belief that there wouldn't be carbon regulation to the certainty that there will be carbon regulation. Actually, we're probably at the point where it's virtually certain that there will be, but it isn't there yet. And it's natural that this changes companies' plans and accentuates uncertainties compared to, let's say, how companies might have felt in 2003 when there was nothing going on in Congress and the administration had tried to put a stake through the Clean Air Act, and it didn't look like anything was going to happen. So that's a time I've described as the little ice age in global warming policy in Washington. But things have changed, and more companies have realized that and stated publicly that either it's desirable or inevitable to see carbon regulated. And in the meantime, not knowing how and when it will be regulated creates these uncertainties that Paul was describing. And our response as the environmental community is that there's really an opportunity for a marriage between what it would take to solve the environmental uncertainties and what it would take to solve the business uncertainties. We both need a plan. One that solves the environmental problem, and two that gives the predictability for investments and creates the stability, takes the volatility out of markets. So that's why in the last few months you've seen quite a number of big companies joining with my organization and now five other, so now it's now about 20 companies and six environmental organizations who are members of the United States Climate Action Partnership, which is has agreed that what we need is legislation as soon as possible, and has agreed on a set of targets, near, medium, and long-term targets that would, from our point of view, go a long way to solving the environmental risk, and from the company's point of view, go a long way to eliminating the uncertainty that in business. So what business would be trading, obviously, is they would be accepting a set of obligations, but they would get some clarity about what they are and some stability in what they will be over a period of time which is relevant to the investments that power companies have to make and car companies have to make and so on. So we think there's something in this for both sides, so to speak, and that's the basis on which we are working towards finding a legislative solution. But in the meantime, what we're also doing is trying to use every lever that exists under existing law to get as far as we can, and frankly, to create as much uncertainty as can be created in lieu of positive action. But the hand is out there to reach the agreement, the deal that resolves things in a mutually beneficial way.
What I'm going to try and do, there's a few more questions I have here, but just so everybody sort of fast-forwarding here is ask about, try and get about 10 minutes more of discussion going and then open it up to the audience. And one of the questions that I had wanted to ask Norm about is there are some public nuisance cases that have been filed with respect to climate change. Probably the one that is best known involves Connecticut and the American Electric Power Company. And Norma, the district court dismissed that case, said that the public nuisance involved sort of a large political question for which there really wasn't a legal rule that the court felt like they could apply. That's on appeal to the Second Circuit. Is there any reason to think that Massachusetts versus EPA might affect the outcome of that or similar cases?
Well, and I am counsel to one of the utility defendants in that litigation that John referred to, and that's now pending in the Second Circuit. So obviously, I do have a particular point of view on this. We take the position in the case that there is no federal, even before Massachusetts v. EPA, that there is no federal common law of nuisance that could be applied, at least in the circumstances of that case. I think that Massachusetts versus EPA is not good news to the plaintiffs in that state, at least on that issue, in that the Supreme Court has now said that Congress meant to authorize greenhouse gas regulation under the Clean Air Act, at least in the broadest sense. And in light of that, the conclusion has to be that there is, again, in the broadest sense, a statutory remedy available that Congress has provided. And the case law says that when Congress has spoken to an issue, there is no federal common law to apply. So I do think that although this has not been fleshed out in full-scale briefing in the Second Circuit, it may be this Second Circuit has not ordered briefing. There were some short letters submitted by each side, one short letter submitted by each side in the case, making certain points about the effect of the Supreme Court's decision. We don't have any decision from the Second Circuit on that issue or any of the several other issues in the case. But I do, as I said, I think the bottom line is that it's, at a minimum, not good news for the plaintiffs in that case.
Not surprisingly, I'm not sure we have the same view of that. Because NRDC also represents the land trusts who are plaintiffs in a consolidated case with the states in that same matter. Excuse me. And so we're all up on appeal. The first thing that the Massachusetts case does is shore up the standing of the states in that case. And the whole basis of the state's standing and their substantive position was Georgia versus Tennessee Copper. So it may, you know, we take some comfort in the fact, A, that the Supreme Court agrees that states and others can sue over the harms posed by global warming, and they do that in part by reliance on Georgia versus Tennessee Copper. But also, the substantive issue in the case is Georgia versus Tennessee Copper, which is an interstate federal common law public nuisance case. So we don't know how the Second Circuit will rule, but in terms of this connection between the common law and the statutory law, our view is that the statutory law can't preempt the common law until it's been exercised. Even though the Supreme Court's ruled there is authority with respect to vehicles, there is no standard for vehicles. There is no resolution of the Clean Air Act case with respect to power plants, the one you were talking about earlier. And so it can't be said that there's been a ruling that the Clean Air Act definitively does apply to the power plants. And even if it does, which we of course do think it does, that power hasn't been exercised, so there's been nothing yet to displace the common law. So we see these two things continuing to barrel down the parallel tracks for a while, and again, that's to the extent that's a source of uncertainty for those industries, that's one of the reasons to come to the table and try to really resolve this.
Well, let me ask sort of a broader question. In Norman, Paul, you've been sort of alluding to this, but besides what we've talked about, what does this case mean for industry?
Well, I think that as David has mentioned, it currently it sort of has led to some uncertainty, but companies are beginning to see that sort of carbon regulation is something that is very likely to happen, and so they need to start planning for it. And so, so I think that you have a lot of companies that are sort of trying to sort of figure out how best to sort of prepare for regulation of carbon. The trading companies, getting people that have a bit of experience in the other emissions trading programs over, also the carbon trading programs in the EU, and just sort of considering it how it impacts their investment decisions in generation, a whole host of factors.
All right.
I think one thing that industry is grappling with, and of course we're still in early days here after the Supreme Court's decision, but I think we have clearly at least the more of a prospect of Clean Air Act regulation of a variety of source categories, with respect to greenhouse gas emissions, than we did before the Supreme Court's decision. And at the same time, as we've talked about, there's intense activity on Capitol Hill, particularly now with Democrats in control of both houses, to develop a variety of legislative proposals to regulate greenhouse gases. And one of the concerns that arises when you look at these two different arenas, the regulatory arena and the legislative arena, is how will this all mesh? If we do have regulatory controls at some point, even if they're somewhat limited in the sense that they might not occur under all sections, all possible sections of the Act, will that work with any new legislative program? And then there are timing questions involved in that as well. So I think that what many in industry are concerned about is having some kind of, and this gets back to the question of certainty, some kind of well thought out legislative scheme, if there is going to be legislation, that does not involve several different layers of regulation, you know, with a new source performance standard here and maybe something under Section 615 and so forth, and then on top of that, some kind of legislative scheme. I think what many in industry will be looking for is some kind of, I'm not sure comprehensive is the right word, but some kind of integrated program that does not involve, as I say, different layers of regulation that I think might only compound the uncertainty that industry now is concerned about.
So from your point of view, the decision makes what you call integrated or comprehensive legislation more likely?
I'm not sure that it makes it more likely, but I do think that if there is legislation, it would be desirable for there to be a serious attempt to craft integrated legislation that takes account of these different factors and does not leave, for example, EPA to continue to develop and perhaps implement programs that are not tied in with that legislative scheme.
Paul, more likely legislation or less?
Well, I think the decision probably does make the legislation more likely, only in the sense that it sort of is the culmination of thought that yes, there is a lot more certainty around, or there's a greater opinion around the problem itself. I mean, that's
okay. David, more likely or less likely that we're going to have legislation?
I think it's more likely. I think that we began this case, as I said, in the Little Ice Age, when there was nothing else to do but to try to pursue the existing authority and make sure that even if it weren't used, that it stayed alive for the use by the next EPA administrators. And I think the fear that, the uncertainty about what this administration will do and the greater uncertainty, maybe in some quarters, fear about what the next administration would do under the existing powers, is a motivator to those who've been on the fence. And so I see more impetus for legislation. That said, writing legislation, as a couple of people have said, like this, is a complex task. It's not like we're starting from zero. There has been a fair amount of preparation for this. I see these 2 years as a chance to refine and build and get to the integrated legislation that solves people's problems. Can you get all the way to the finish line? That depends in part on whether the administration will lend resources, the resources of EPA, as it did in the Bush 1 period, to helping the Congress figure things out. And it depends, of course, what at the top level of the administration, what the president's willing to sign. But even if we don't get to legislation, to final legislation in this Congress, I think we will have built the scaffolding from which to finish the job in the early part of the next one. So it's all time well spent now.
Bob, anything you want to add?
Well, I'm not quite sure if we've had a little ice age during the present administration. If we did, we probably had a medieval warm period during the time of the Cannon Memo existence. So we had a situation, what I'm referring to is that the legal posture of the agency did change between administrations, but in the previous administration, there was a legal viewpoint that carbon dioxide was a pollutant under the Act, and that even with that legal view, it was not exercised upon during the previous administration. But when we look at legislation, I think anything can usually happen. I think from the agency's viewpoint, we're clearly up on the Hill, we're clearly testifying. I think we've been led to expect that there'll be quite a bit of attention to our regulatory processes here, and that there's quite a deal of interest exerted by committees of jurisdiction over what the agency will do. The administrator was up testifying a few weeks ago and has been sort of served with notice he'll be back up there testifying. So I think what will happen on Capitol Hill will be a continuing attention to what we're doing on the regulatory level, and at the same time, I see no, I think, let up in terms of their efforts. I think what is the condition that we face is one of a very complicated issue, and that the broader one looks in terms of the economy, in terms of the sectors, in terms of the sources, the more complicated it becomes to try to fashion legislation that is both precise enough from a certainty standpoint from those who are advocating for that legislation and not so precise in other respects as to try to fill out every little detail for which the legislative process sometimes is not completely suited. So who knows?
Okay, well, thank you. Time for questions from other folks.
The conference has been unmuted.
Yeah. I'm Darren Samuelson, from reporter from Greenwire.
Just speaking to the microphones if you can find one.
I'm Darren Samuelson, reporter from Greenwire, and obviously while this is going on, our BlackBerries are buzzing with all sorts of information, and the White House has released now a fact sheet and announcing an executive order that will put all government agencies into action to regulate. I'm going to ask Bob to kind of clarify this. It looks like it says to coordinate action to regulate greenhouse gases from all kinds of vehicles. It also says to do something to get back to put something up before President Bush leaves office in 2008. And so this is not a substitute for legislative action as well. I guess, Bob, can you just clarify what...
You got better BlackBerry than I do.
everybody, please speak up. We're still getting emails from Flip and Sons.
Have you seen the executive order, I guess?
I haven't seen the executive order that has been signed, apparently, by your announcement on your BlackBerry. But I guess I would say, with respect to coordination, that it's only natural that if one were looking at the issue of motor vehicles, or looking at the issue of fuels used in that vehicle, in motor vehicles, that one would really avail themselves of the expertise of the other agencies that are involved. I mean, obviously, with respect to motor vehicles, the CAFE statute, DOT, NHTSA in particular, has been operating for years in terms of its current authority, and with regard to biofuels or GHG profiles of different fuels, and in terms of life cycle analysis, there's a lot that other departments and agencies can bring to bear on those in terms of resources and in terms of reviews. I mean, if you're looking at vehicles, essentially you're talking about an efficiency type approach. There are other GHG emissions from vehicles. The ICTA petition mentioned 4, but primarily you're talking about an issue of CO2 with regard to vehicles. If you're talking fuels, and you're talking about it. It's a unique issue with respect to looking not at the carbon emissions out the tailpipe as we do other emissive standards out of automobiles, but as to life cycle production and creation of those fuels and how that's done and what the energy inputs in there are, and up into including things like fertilizer for natural gas fertilizer for corn ethanol. So I think, you know, I think we said again today that these issues are very complicated, and to the extent that that NAFR can draw upon the resources of other departments and agencies, I think that's just good government.
I didn't see stationary sources on this list. Are they, is this part of what you've been asked to do?
Again, I don't have the, I don't know what's on your BlackBerry versus mine. I was just referring to what I think your question said.
Other questions? Well, I have more questions. No one else asks questions, I will. Okay, I'll ask another question. One of the things that happened in Massachusetts versus EPA was the court addressed some of the objections that EPA had raised to regulating greenhouse gas emissions. EPA said, for example, the Energy Policy and Conservation Act, under which the CAFE standards are adopted, was the proper vehicle, not the Clean Air Act. The EPA said this is a decision that has foreign affairs implications. That's another reason for us not to decide the case. And the Supreme Court addressed both of those points critically in its decision. Now, that part of the decision has implications for a couple of different cases, or may have implications for a couple of different cases where auto manufacturers and dealers and others have challenged California's clean car standards. And there was a trial that's been going on in Vermont over the last several weeks, considering the question of whether the Vermont's adoption of the California standards is in fact a CAFE standard, because if what Vermont did amounts to a CAFE standard, then it would be preempted. And I guess there's the Vermont case and the sort of the way that discussion it has been going, and what the Supreme Court said may arguably point in slightly different directions. And I was wondering if anybody could sort of help us think about whether Massachusetts versus EPA shares on those cases and what it might mean for them.
I sort of seem to be everywhere. We're defending that lawsuit along with the state of Vermont and others. And of course, that's a key question. And you need to recall that at the beginning of this case, the auto company's primary contention was that EPA could not grant California the waiver because California can only do what EPA can do, and EPA can't regulate carbon dioxide. So once the Supreme Court even took the case, the automakers started to walk away from that argument. And now they're completely giving that one up because it's obvious that EPA can regulate CO2. So if California's actions need to be consistent with EPA's, they certainly would be if they were regulating carbon dioxide. The second thing the companies have been saying is, as you, John, summarized it, is that this is a fuel economy standard. And fuel economies, state fuel economy standards are preempted under the fuel economy statute. And our response has been, no, it's not. It's an emissions standard. It says it's an emissions standard. It's set up as an emissions standard. And I think the Supreme Court case helps us a lot on that because it says that both agencies, both statutes apply, even though they overlap. And the fact that the fact that DOT is instructed to regulate fuel economy is no reason why EPA should not regulate CO2 from tailpipes. They can work together. there's a sort of technical argument that there is a provision in the fuel economy law, in APCA, which says that NHTSA is supposed to consider the fuel economy impacts of, quote, other motor vehicle standards of the government. And when you track back what other motor vehicle standards of the government means, you find that it used to, in a slightly different version earlier, it said federal motor vehicle standards, and that term was expressly defined to include a set of obviously federal standards, but also included were standards applicable by reason of 209B of the Clean Air Act. So what we have said throughout this case is that when EPA grants a waiver to a California standard, it becomes a federal standard. It becomes an other motor vehicle standard of the government. And it's not a state standard anymore. So wholly apart from whether it's about emissions or fuel economy, the state preemption clause doesn't apply because it's not a state standard anymore. And I think that's the way this case, that's one of the conclusions I should not venture to project, but there's a good chance that the judge will reach that conclusion. So the automakers, in my mind, are destined to lose their preemption argument under the fuel economy law as well as their arguments under the Clean Air Act. They have arguments, a third argument, which is that it's a violation of the foreign policy of the United States for the states to be issuing these standards. And the argument goes like this, that the EPA said about its own actions in 2003 that those would take away a bargaining chip in the negotiations with China and other countries. Since then, the administration's articulated over and over again two things. One, that it's seeking not any kind of concessionary binding obligations agreement with other countries, but only voluntary non-concessionary agreements. And the second thing is that it keeps telling the parties to the Framework Convention that among the great things the United States has done to implement its obligations under the Framework Convention is that the states have been acting and the states have set these greenhouse gas emission standards. So I don't think the car companies are going to do very well with the argument that the states' actions are contrary to the foreign policy of the United States.
Anybody else on the preemption issues?
We're not involved, and I'm not involved in the litigation over the California waiver. But I think that the one of the issues that's, if I'm not mistaken, David, one of the issues that's been argued already in the Vermont case, the Vermont case being really the first to go to trial on these state.
Yeah, it's bizarre that the California standards are being tried in Burlington, Vermont.
Right. In fact, I believe the closing arguments were May 8th. In that. I think one of the issues there is whether what the Supreme Court said in Massachusetts versus EPA about the fact that in the court's view, EPA and the Department of Transportation should be able to work cooperatively together to address these issues concerning motor vehicle emissions of greenhouse gases and the fuel economy standards, whether that language somehow determines the outcome, determines the result of the argument, which I believe the judge referred to as a separate argument, that EPCA, the CAFE program, preempts state regulation. And it'll be very interesting, I think, to see how the judge in the Vermont case addresses that issue. I do think, in looking quickly at the transcript of the closing argument, it did seem to me that the court was not assuming that what the Supreme Court did on that issue resolves the state preemption issue with respect to EPCA. I don't know, David, if you have a different view
on
that.
Well, also in those closing arguments, there's an interesting exchange between the judge and the counsel for the auto companies in which the judge, who is a kind of very open, think-out-loud kind of judge, and he hasn't ruled on anything, but you follow his questions and his queries very carefully. He said, now EPA has to make this decision on the waiver, and the defendants, meaning us, have told him, the judge, that in the past EPA has sometimes issued the waiver with changes to the lead time or changes to the content of the standards. And he asked the auto companies, do you think EPA has that power? And they've been hemming and hawing. But the judge said, now this, if this is true, this changes things quite a bit, because the Supreme Court in the federal to federal context said there's room for EPA and NHTSA to coordinate, you know, or what's the phrase, that the two obligations may overlap, but there's no reason to think the two agencies cannot both administer their obligations and yet avoid inconsistency. So the judge in Vermont is saying, at least as a hypothetical, he hasn't ruled yet, that if EPA has flexibility, not just up or down authority to respond to the waiver, then the situation is quite a bit the same. And could not, he asks, EPA and NHTSA talk to each other. Now, we're going to file some things that describe our views about the nature of the conversation or the procedures that NHTSA and EPA have to follow. And the point we're making is that the decision has to be made under the Section 209 criteria about technology and lead time and so on. Within those criteria, if NHTSA has something to say, they can say it. And there's various ways in which the agencies of the federal government can talk to each other.
I would just add, this is all very fascinating from a timing standpoint, because of course EPA has its public proceeding now underway on granting the California waiver. Well, we've just concluded a trial in Vermont on essentially, you know, I'm oversimplifying, essentially the California waiver. And I think the judge himself was struggling a little bit about the question of how all of this is going to intersect with each other. And I imagine EPA is struggling with the same thing right now.
Well, and we've been, you know, recommending to him or stating our view that essentially all the concerns the companies have raised under EPCA, not all of them, but all the central ones about their claims about technology, lead time, cost, are pertinent under 209B. They have the burden, as Bob said earlier, of making, the opponents have the burden of proof in the waiver proceeding, but they have the opportunity to come in and show that California's judgments are too far, too fast. Of course, California and we will defend the California's judgments as being on the mark. But what we're saying is this issue has a forum to be resolved through the waiver proceeding, and there'll be judicial review available after the waiver proceeding. There really isn't a basis for a preemption case for that reason, and the reason I gave earlier, namely that the fuel economy at law itself treats EPA standards that have the waiver, not as state standards, sorry, California standards that have the waiver, not as state standards, but as federal standards, and they're not subject to the preemption clause.
You know, Bob, I'd be sort of not doing my job if I didn't give you a chance to respond to all this.
I think, fortunately or unfortunately, in this case, we're not party to the litigation, so... I think it gives me an out in terms of it's been an interesting dialogue in between David here and Norm. So, but we're not part of this litigation. There's some relevance, obviously, but I don't think I need to comment on litigation. We're a party of plenty of litigation.
John, a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Kathy Cash of Platts Electricity Publications. A question for Norm and Bob and David. I've heard conflicting ideas whether EPA under Clean Air Act can use the cost-benefit analysis as a tool to regulate power plants for greenhouse gases. Clarify that for me, that
EPA Clean Act and the Clean Air Act use cost benefit.
John,
Kathy, can I let me see if I've got this question right. You're asking whether EPA can use cost benefit analysis to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. Mm-hmm. That's the question.
Yeah.
Okay, and you were asking Norm and Paul that.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave.
Kathy, I think that if you're talking about Section 111 new source performance standards, costs and feasibility are clearly the really the governing factors that that EPA is to consider. The sort of shorthand phrase for the technology that's to be adopted is best demonstrated technology. So the technology has to be demonstrated. It can't be a technology that is pie in the sky or experimental or in test stage. Now, there's some dispute around the margins as to how how you actually define that criterion and implement it. But I think that's sort of the core of the analysis that EPA has to engage in. So, without getting into whether it's cost benefit, which tends to be a red flag to a lot of people and has a lot of implications, I do think it's important to look at the costs under that particular program.
Paul?
Well, I think she had directed the questions to others, and being the energy lawyer, I will have to sort of say I can't expound any better than Norm on EPA's authority.
All right.
How about that?
David.
Yeah, well, just quickly, I agree with Norm. Cost and feasibility are relevant factors. In the history of the new source performance standard and the other technology-based programs where cost and feasibility are relevant, there have sometimes been brush fires about cost-benefit analysis as a particular way of analyzing costs. And the courts generally have said, no, the kind of feasibility analysis that's required under statutes like that is not the same as cost-benefit analysis. That's a big question. But coincidentally, it's being argued right now in the Ninth Circuit, where there is a CAFE case being argued, and one of the issues is whether the transportation, the NHTSA's decision to turn a feasibility statute into a marginal cost, marginal benefit statute is a violation of the fuel economy law. And that argument is going on right now in San Francisco.
And you got that in your BlackBerry?
No, we were preparing for that on Friday.
All right. Other questions from anybody? Yeah.
This is Andy Patterson from Econergy. I have a question to extend Don's issue about what impact this is going to have on industry to what impact this might have on the investment community. This might go to Paul and Norm firstly. On the mobile sources side, and I'd like to get to the stationary side, but on the mobile sources side, you have GM and Ford, whose bond ratings are basically in the toilet. Daimler dumped Chrysler overboard this morning. You have basically an auto industry in the United States that's flat on its back and may not be able to make the investments or get the support from the investment markets to handle this issue regardless of the legal outcomes. They may just end up paying the fines. If the pension and health care liabilities are not taken care of, they may just go into bankruptcy like we saw with the merchant energy industry. What might the impact be, or what the reaction might be in the investment circles to where we're going with mobile sources, and then how might that look in the stationary sources?
I think it's interesting on the motor vehicle side, again, referring to the Vermont case that just finished trial, I think there was some evidence presented and arguments made regarding the financial ability, well, perhaps more the technological and practical ability of the automobile companies, but also perhaps on the financial side as well, to meet dramatically more stringent CAFE standards, or however you want to characterize them, whether they're CAFE or greenhouse gas emission regulations. the plaintiffs in that case, the automobile manufacturers, characterized the state standards, and these are California standards, Vermont standards. I think about a dozen other states have adopted them as well, so it's a substantial part of the country. Really would require dramatic increases in fuel efficiency. And there was, I believe, a fair amount of evidence presented on both sides, I think, about the feasibility of meeting those limits. But some of the statements by the automobile manufacturers in that case were pretty dire about their ability to do that. And I'm not sure if that goes directly to their financial situation or simply their technological ability to handle these changes. But in any event, I think it presents some questions. And I think, for example, they were even making statements about job losses associated with making these changes. So if the investment community takes a look at that kind of information, and if these standards do go into effect and have to be implemented, it could cause some real concern there. As far as the stationary source side is concerned, I mean, it's such a wide variety of source categories, but frankly, you can imagine scenarios where if you had stringent, very stringent greenhouse gas regulations, you could see some manufacturers decide to, this is the tipping point, they're going to relocate overseas where they don't face these kinds of regulations, again, depending on the type of business. Some businesses can do that more easily than others. The power industry cannot, by and large. I mean, there are imports from Canada of electricity. There are some imports even from Mexico. But by and large, the electric power industry cannot do that. The physical constraints of transmission lines and so forth largely prevent that from happening. So it's a critically important question for the electric utility industry. What kind of regulation will there be if there is regulation? What would the timetable be for implementing that? How stringent? What degree of flexibility will be provided? And real questions about control technology. Carbon capture and sequestration, particularly for coal plants, is a huge issue with tremendous implications regarding regulatory structure, federal and state levels of control. You know, what are the roles of the federal government and the state governments? Liability questions, tremendous uncertainty in that area. A lot of challenges facing, I think, the power industry in that area. I don't mean to be alarmist about it, because I'm not suggesting that these challenges could not be overcome with enough time and resources, but they are huge challenges.
Wouldn't it immediately favor renewables, energy efficiency, and nuclear, regardless of the regs?
Nuclear is an interesting one because, of course, there's tremendous resistance from many in the environmental community to expanded nuclear power, not just the environmental community, but others as well. Renewables, clearly, you know, a lot's going on. A lot of development of wind energy continues. I would expect that almost regardless of what happens, there will be continuing interest in developing that part of the power sector.
Yeah, and let me also just add to that in fact, you're seeing a lot of investment money sort of going into the sort of the greener side of the power industry, with a lot of hedge funds as well as other sort of traditional investment in the research for new technologies, as well as sort of the wind and sort of, obviously, you referred to the biofuel. Or someone referred to the biofuels earlier. I think actually it was Bob, where, you know, very significant investment because of some of the environmental issues that the investment community sees coming down the road. On the mobile source, you identify a difficult problem.
Well, we're just about out of time. In fact, we're a couple minutes over time, and so just for the fun of it, what I want to ask everybody here, and this is like a one-word answer, is if you look at Supreme Court decisions in on the environment, and if you want to characterize them in terms of their importance, where one is just another Supreme Court decision on the environment, and five is landmark. Okay, how would you, in 10 years, what do you think people are going to say about Massachusetts versus EPA?
Landmark squared.
Norm?
One word answer, huh?
Two, three,
four. Four.
Four, four sounds right to me.
Bob?
In 4 years, in 10 years?
Yeah.
It's important. Important.
All right, we'll let it go at that. You got the last word and the first word. Thanks again to Huntman Williams, to Bill Fang, Scott Chang, and to Jim Rubin, and especially to our panelists. Please give them all, those of you who are still here, a round of applause.